Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm very pleased to have as my guest today Dave King, and we're going to be discussing his novel, The Ha Ha, which was published by Little Brown in 05, will be available in paperback in March of 06 by Back Bay Books. And first of all, Dave, thank you much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Dave, the Ha Ha is, I found it to be a very satisfying novel. And tell us a little bit about, I know that you had a brother who was autistic, but this is not based on him. So if you would tell us.
I like to be clear about that. My brother was profoundly autistic and never spoke in his life. And I think my interest in disability and of what it means to be different or to be, you know, other from the norm certainly stems from my experience of having, you know, a disabled kid in the family. The main character in the Ha Ha is Howard Kapostash, who also doesn't speak. And so I think I can say that the spark for an interest in that came from my brother Hank, but that the character is really a wholly imagined creation. And the difference there is that Howard is a young man who is living a normal life of average expectations until he's sent to Vietnam, and there a mine explosion causes a brain injury, and that's when he loses his power of speech. So the primary dynamic in the novel has a great deal to do with a sense of loss and of regret, which I hope that my brother actually didn't feel, since he was born with his disability and really knew no other experience.
Now, Dave, how hard was that stylistic for you to have your primary narrator not be able to speak, to really live more of an interior life?
Well, that was the primary task and challenge of writing the book. Obviously, it was one of the generating, I don't know, I think it's fair to call it a bit of a gimmick, but it was one of the generating points, was that the character will be able to open up to the reader in a way that the other characters in the book are unaware of. And so the reader is privy to Howard's interior life, whereas the other characters really see him as a much more limited individual. So that was the challenge, and the way I resolved that was in two ways. One, by certainly trying to make his inner life as true and honest as it could be at each point in the book. And then secondly, trying to find a style and a diction which was precise and also interesting to the reader. You ask the reader to climb inside someone's head for 330 pages, and that's a lot to swallow. And so certainly creating that inner voice was the thing that I worked hardest at. It was what I rewrote and thought about and really worked on most over the years that I was completing the novel. And it was all in the service of, you know, trying to make it not only an interesting story, but an engaging book to, you know, make Howard an engaging companion for the ride.
Yeah. How many drafts and how long did it take you to write the Ha Ha?
I would say it took about 6 years. I was doing other things at the time. During part of that, I was in graduate school, and then of course, there's this nasty question of having to earn a living. And I teach. I teach at Baruch College. And also at the School of Visual Arts. So, it wasn't as though I was working on the novel 8 hours a day for 6 years, but I would say it took about that much time. The question of drafts is a little trickier because there were certain scenes, the beginning scene and the final scene, which I must have rewritten 20 or 30 times. Maybe not 30, but certainly at least 20 times. And I wrote a lot, which I subsequently threw out. I think that's my method. I write scenes, and they seem to work, and then when I go back and question, you know, where I'm going with the book, I'm very quick to throw stuff away and just say, well, do something else. So I would say maybe four or five complete drafts, and in at least two of them, I really changed the language. I wrote a draft that was in very, very simple, kind of plain Midwestern diction, and then realized that it was boring. And I also wrote a draft that was in iambic pentameter. I thought it would be an interesting idea if the inside of Howard's head was in some way ornate or poetic, and that would emphasize the kind of gap between his own inner life and the experience of the other characters. And so, and I was writing a lot of poetry at the time. It was when I was at Columbia, and so I wrote about 70 pages of this thing. I rewrote about 70 pages of this thing in iambic pentameter before realizing that, you know, I'm not exactly Byron, and was unlikely to be able to sustain that for 300 pages.
Sure.
So then I went back to prose, but that experiment was really, really helpful in figuring out what I wanted Howard's voice to be like.
Now, one of the things I particularly enjoyed about Howard is that those of us that know people that are I don't know what the proper term is, but have disabilities or are challenged,
mm-hmm.
you have a tendency to think that they don't have the capacity to feel love, anger, hate. And I think you really did a nice job with Howard of telling the reader how he does fall in love with this boy, Ryan, and how he cares for him so much, even though he doesn't want to at the start.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I'm glad you felt that. Obviously, one of the things that I, you know, decided to do fairly early on was to give Howard as rich and full an inner life as I could, particularly emotionally. And at the beginning of the book, he doesn't have very many outlets for his emotions. And so I think one thing that happens over the course of the book, and one of the things that readers respond to, is that he kind of reclaims his own heart. He comes to realize the importance of the human connection, something he's renounced. And also, he comes, conversely, to experience a resurgence of rage at what the war cost him. And I think that it's the balance of these two responses over the course of the novel that creates the conflict in the second half of the book.
Now, you also, I think, do a very nice job of kind of looking at the nature of families versus the family of origin that we're born into, and then the family kind of that we choose as we go along. And it's really kind of an interesting family that they kind of pick themselves as they go along in the book, and it ends up, you end up really caring for a lot of the characters, and they all go through, you know, some tragedies. And I really thought it was interesting that Howard, even though he couldn't verbally express himself a lot of times, he ends up being the leader of the family.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm glad you recognize that. Over the course of the novel, the characters in this household do kind of form into a kind of ad hoc family, and Howard, possibly by virtue of his age, but also by assuming a certain authority, becomes the dad figure. And that's really important to the book. I'm interested in family. One of the things I sort of recognized midway through the writing process was that the only real nuclear family in the kind of American dream sense is the family of Howard's childhood, the remembered family of his mother and father and himself. And most of the contemporary families are somehow more modern. There's a Sylvia is, I guess, the antagonist of the book, and she's a single mother raising a child. There's a single father. There's a lesbian couple raising a child. And then there's this kind of group of strangers who form a kind of community in the house. And I did want to express something about family, but also about our shared responsibility to care for each other, whether we're related by blood or not, and you know, the possibilities of generosity and kindness, which is what I hope most of the people, most of the characters in the book discover before it's over.
Now, when you approached Little Brown, or your agent approached Little Brown with this novel, what was their first reaction, and how important was the editorial process in bringing this book to publication?
Well, they were very they were enthusiastic about the manuscript, and they were very supportive of the book that I wanted to publish. They didn't ask for a lot of changes, which I was grateful for. That was important to me. I mean, I had worked hard on the book. I was satisfied with what it was, and I got some suggestions, you know, particularly to maybe condense a scene or two. But in general, I was given a great deal of leeway. And I think the fact that my publisher went with this very unusual title, The Ha Ha, and took a chance on it, is also an expression of their faith in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a challenging title for book buyers, and I'm really grateful that that Little Brown decided to go with it. And I also think that it's proved a decent marketing strategy, because people have, you know, it's proved memorable.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about what the ha ha is.
Well, the ha ha is a phrase that I first discovered in an architecture history class in undergraduate school, and what it is a kind of concealed boundary in a large tract of land, so that the land appears to go on forever, but in fact there's a kind of wall built into the hillside, which prevents the animals, say, from leaving one pasture and going into another. And so the point is this illusion of continuity, where in fact there's a rift. Ha-has are pretty familiar in Britain, particularly in the big country houses. We don't use that term so much here in the U.S., although people who are familiar with Central Park will recognize that the places where the roads run east and west through the park are essentially ha-has. They, you know, the park is, the land is built up in a way to kind of conceal the fact that the road is running through. So there's a ha-ha in the novel. It's a kind of funkier, more American version than what you'd find on an English estate. But it's certainly a ha-ha. And it figures symbolically in the novel because Howard has a kind of rift in the landscape of his own life. There's a break there that at the beginning of the book he's acutely aware of, but hasn't really acknowledged or resolved in the way that he's moving towards resolving it by the end of the story. So that's my interpretation of the symbolism, although I've had readers approach me and say that they felt that Howard himself was kind of like a ha-ha, in that he presented a very contained facade, but that you didn't really know the specifics of what was inside him.
Yeah, that makes sense. What do you think your brother would think of this novel?
You know, I think one of the mysteries is that I do not know what my brother thought.
Mm-hmm.
He loved music. He loved to dance. He rode horses and his bicycle. He was a hyperactive child, and then a very active adult. But he was a low-functioning autistic guy in terms of reading, anything like that. He never went to school. I hope that he would, you know, appreciate it as a tribute to the degree it's a tribute to him. I know my father thinks of it that way. But I'm not certain that he would have much access to it, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dave, I understand you have, in addition to being an author, you have other artistic endeavors as well. Tell the listeners, if you would, a little bit about some of the other things that you do.
Well, I took a really long and roundabout route to becoming a writer. I think I always wanted to be a writer. I wrote what I thought of as a novel when I was a teenager. You know, it was about 45 pages long in pencil and a steno pad. But then in my 20s, I became a painter, and my undergraduate degree was in painting and film. I tried to have a career as a fine artist for about 10 years, learned a lot about creativity, but didn't have much commercial success. And then I started a small business that painted murals for residential interiors, and I did that for about 10 years. And we were very successful. We worked at the White House and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and we worked for a number of very celebrated private clients. And it was fun running a business, and I was actually good at it. But at some point along the way, I realized that I had drifted kind of far from the creative life that I set out to lead as an undergraduate. And I tried to figure out a way to resolve that. So I took a writing class at the West Side Y here in New York, and then I took another. And ultimately, one of the teachers, a really wonderful and wise novelist called Melvin Jules Bouquet, sat me down and he said, you know, I think you could do something with this. And if you want to, then you need to make a commitment. You can't continue to work 40 hours a week and just write on nights and weekends. You may think it's heroic, but it's a bit of a cop-out. And if you're really serious about this, go to graduate school, get an MFA, place yourself in the writing world, and see what happens. And I took that advice to heart, and I gave up my half of the business, and at 42 I went to Columbia.
Beautiful.
And the HaHa actually was my graduate thesis, although it was pretty different when I turned it in. Particularly the second half of the book was quite different than it is now.
Now, I know, Dave, I know you're working on your second novel now, is that correct?
I am.
Now, how hard has it been to shift gears and write about something else after writing about something which was so personal to you?
It hasn't been that easy. I have two novels sort of underway, and I'm working, I've chosen to work on one of them for a while. One thing was that I did not foresee that the book would be received as well as it has been. I thought I was writing a book for kind of a limited audience, and that my life would not change. But the book has been really well received, and I've had a year of quite a lot of book touring and stuff like that. And so in that sense, it was simply hard to sit down and get to work again. And then when I did sit down, I kept hearing the voice of Howard Kapostash in my head, and I was trying to write about someone who was a young actor in New York, and a very different kind of situation. And so I complained about this to a friend of mine who's a novelist called Alex Michaud, and I said, well, I just feel like I'm just going to write Howard again. And he said, well, why don't you just go with that, sit down and write Howard, but as if he's a young actor in New York, and it'll change. And he was absolutely right. It did begin to change. I began to, use New York references rather than Midwestern references. Of course, my new character could speak and was very aware of his voice and his body and the way he presented himself. And pretty soon, Howard had kind of shimmered out of the picture and the new guy was more present for me. I was very grateful to my friend Alec for encouraging me to just go ahead and do that.
That's great. Dave, what are you happiest about with the HaHa now that it's, you've had the hardcover, it's coming out paperback in March, it's had success. I think it's a wonderful Christmas gift for someone who wants to read a very nice literate novel. What are you happiest about the book?
Well, of course, thank you for the recommendation, first of all, and I'm really grateful for the number of people who've taken this book up and really respond to it. That's a glorious feeling, and I have to say, not something I had quite foreseen. I didn't know what it would feel like to have readers read my book. I guess if I had to single out one thing, there's a certain place in the novel where things change, and the novel becomes quite a bit darker than it had been. And I knew I wanted to do that. I'm basically a pretty sunny person, and so the first two-thirds of the book are pretty sunny, and that was comfortable for me. And then I wanted the book to really enter a kind of I worked very hard on that. And I think that's what I'm proudest of, the fact that I was able to pull that off and do something that cuts very much against the grain of my own sort of outlook.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I have to say, if I single one thing out, the praise and the sales and all of that have been really wonderful. They're delightful. I'm overjoyed by them. But you know, the sense of achievement is really what matters ultimately in the end.
Well, Dave, I want to thank you for taking time away from your busy schedule to talk to us today.
Well, thank you, Casey.
And I'd like to have you back on when the next novel comes out. And I'd like to recommend to all the readers that they go out and get the Ha Ha, because I know they will not be sorry when they read it.
Well, I'd love to come back, and it's been a pleasure speaking to you, Casey. Thank you very, very much for having me on the show.
Take care.